Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Our hour of stories begins today with the Airways. The commercial German Wings jetliner crash in the French Alps appears to have been a deliberate act by the co-pilot. And a deliberate new bombing campaign in Yemen by Saudi Arabia has caused turmoil in world oil markets. We begin with the German Wings crash. We're learning that the final moments of the flight of the German Wings jetliner — German Wings is a division of the German airline giant Lufthansa — that crashed in the French Alps on Tuesday seems to have been a terrifying life-and-death battle between members of the flight crew.
The co-pilot was on his own in the cockpit. While alone, the co-pilot manipulated the flight monitoring system keys so that to accelerate the descent of the plane. We could hear a number of appeals and calls from the pilot to access the cockpit. We heard a breathing noise, and we carried on hearing that kind of breathing until the final crash, which means that the co-pilot was still alive until the time of the impact.
That's Marseille prosecutor Brice Robin citing evidence from the cockpit voice recorder revealing that the co-pilot, 28-year-old Andreas Lubitz, deliberately locked the captain out of the cockpit and drove the plane into its fatal descent. There are questions about why a locked cockpit couldn't be opened by a pilot and what the motive might have been for deliberately crashing the plane. Joining me now is Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler and a contributor to PopularMechanics.com. Welcome back, Barbara.
Good to be here.
This is a pretty terrifying story. There are questions about, first of all, the demeanor of the co-pilot, and then why you can lock a door and not have the pilot get back into it. Can you address both of those?
Well, yes. I mean, it's obviously a total shock, this revelation that came out. I think no one expected this. And so it's fair to say everybody is still reacting to it. But what we do know is that unlike the policy here in the United States, it does not appear that all airlines in Europe and elsewhere in the world have a policy that there must always be two people in the cockpit who are approved to be in the cockpit. So just for a little bit of background, what happened was after 9/11, the emphasis was on securing the cockpit door, because, of course, that's how the hijackers were able to carry out their deadly deed. And they made them very secure. And, of course, now we're asking, maybe they were too secure, because once someone in there is intent on keeping someone out, and, of course, that was meant to keep out a bad guy, it could also keep out someone who ought to be in there. There are various checks and balances there to override it, but it seemed like they did not work in this case.
And the voice recorder, how clear is the vocal sounds? I mean, are we hearing the ambient sound within the plane itself? Is it just in the cockpit? Would they be hearing the pilot sound muffled through the door, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it can pick up sounds outside the door, depending on how loud it is. And yes, I do think the quality is actually quite high. Now, what we don't know yet is how many of the streams, of the audio streams, they've been able to capture. It can capture more than one. So we're not sure yet if they've really done the kind of analysis that I'm told by the investigators I've talked to takes weeks. So this came out very rapidly.
Let's talk a little bit about what the data recorder would say. It sounds like that's going to confirm that someone deliberately did something to cause this descent, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The data recorder is very important, because really when you want to analyze what happened, you take both the voice recorder and the data recorder, which has hundreds of different parameters in there, which can tell you really what was going on in the entire plane, you know, from the tail to the cockpit. And one of the things it may tell us that we don't know, because this is a fairly older model of this particular aircraft, is whether or not it can tell us about the locking mechanism and how that came about, whether or not it was intentional or not. That may shed some light on it, but we really don't know until they've had a chance to find it, and they haven't found it yet.
Barbara Peterson is senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler and a contributor to PopularMechanics.com. Moving to the Middle East now, the unstable country of Yemen has crossed some line for the Saudis. They have begun bombing targets of Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen. The action has roiled oil markets, and it's unclear if the bombing will settle anything down in Yemen.
The use of force is always the last resort, and it is with great reluctance that we took this step, along with our partners in the GCC countries, as well as outside of the GCC countries.
That's the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Adel El Jubeir, speaking at a news conference last night. Pro-Iranian Houthis have swept through the capital city of Sana'a, forcing President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi to seek refuge in the southern port city of Aden, where he may have hopped a boat. Yemeni President Hadi is an ally of the United States, and White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest denounced the actions of the Houthis at a news conference yesterday.
The actions of the Houthis and former President Saleh have caused widespread instability and chaos that threatens the well-being of all Yemenis.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif has also condemned the military operations in Yemen. Joining me now is Iona Craig, a reporter who has covered Yemen for many years. Welcome back, Iona.
Hi there.
So, Iona, what do you think is unfolding in Yemen right now? Is the society falling apart? Is the government falling apart? Or is essentially a Shiite coup slowly taking place and an Iranian influence is coming in to replace the government?
Well, the government really collapsed already some weeks, if not months ago. The Houthis took control of the capital back in September last year and consolidated that earlier this year when the government then stepped down. President Hadi resigned and all the ministers were put under house arrest. So the predominantly Shia rebel group have been in control for some time. It's been a slow burning coup, really. But I think, you know, to play this as an Iranian takeover, certainly the Iranians support the Houthis in their rhetoric, but there isn't really a huge amount of evidence that backs up that they support them in strongly in any other way, i.e. militarily or strategically in what they've been doing in Yemen.
Do the Saudis want the world to believe that the Iranians have their influence in Yemen and that justifies their influence in trying to perhaps constrain the Houthis?
Yes, I'm sure there's an element of that. The concern for Saudi Arabia would be that this is a Shia group that is taking control of Yemen. And in the last few days were threatening the southern city of Aden, which is strategically very important to the Bab el-Mandab Strait, where a huge amount of oil passes through those waters every day between the Gulf of Aden and up through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal. So it's strategically very important and also then plays into this whole Saudi versus Iranian regional issue as well.
Would the Houthis want to disrupt that oil transport?
I don't think they would, but if they're put under pressure, they might. And of course, what we've seen overnight with these airstrikes is putting them under pressure. But if they continue to hit their military bases and where they're holding weapons, then they may struggle to do much about that. And I think that's really the Saudis' aim, is to constrain the Houthis, force them into negotiations and stop them from taking more control in Yemen and really consolidating their power in the Arabian Peninsula.
But in the short term, it's the Saudis that have precipitated all kinds of instability in the oil markets, not the Yemenis at this point, wouldn't you say?
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, I think this has already had an impact on oil prices overnight. But, this is a huge domestic problem that could arguably have been avoided in the first place. Going back to 2011 and 2012 during the Arab Spring, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who has since been supporting the Houthis, he was granted immunity after he stepped down from power in 2012, and he was able to remain in Yemen. So he became heavily involved from the sidelines in manipulating what happened thereafter. And so now it seems to be rather ironic that the GCC deal that was signed and very much backed by America and by the West and, of course, the Saudis, that deal was made with Ali Abdullah Saleh, granting him all of those things. And now they're effectively bombing him out of the country as well, because the military bases they're really going after are the bases that still remained loyal to Ali Abdullah Saleh and have been supporting the Houthis' efforts over the last year.
And the GCC that you refer to is the Gulf Cooperation Council, which attempted to constrain the instability in Yemen. And as you've said, has been unsuccessful. What do you think the impact has been for Yemenis on the streets of the cities in Yemen and even in the countryside?
I think it's been, you know, quite horrifying for them over the last 24 hours, certainly. I don't think any of them really anticipated the Saudis doing this. They thought that perhaps there would be airstrikes from the talk over the last few days, but then bombing the capital city and the concern, therefore, over residential areas, you know, it's not a city that's prepared for any of that. And so I think it's been very shocking for them. But the level of violence and conflict has been escalating quite rapidly over the last few weeks. And of course, you've got to remember that it's the poorest country in the Middle East. 16 million Yemenis out of a population of 25 million are in need of humanitarian aid. So real basic day-to-day life for them is hard anyway, without adding conflict on top of that, as well as this additional now operation by the Saudis and the regional powers.
Finally, Iona Craig, can you evaluate reports that we've seen that the rebels have managed to compromise U.S. Intelligence operations going on in Yemen, the drone operations, which killed some al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula officials, including Sheikh al-Awlaki. Any indication that they've managed to compromise or disrupt those activities?
I think really the concern over this is the National Security Bureau, which was one of Yemen's intelligence agencies that was really created by the US and very central to their counterterrorism program, to the drone program, and to their human intelligence on the ground. Now, when the Houthis took control of Sana'a in September and then consolidated that earlier this year, meant that they effectively had control of the NSB, as it's known in Yemen. And that's the area where intelligence is used from in order to carry out counterterrorism operations and drone strikes. So, yes, that's very crucial, because the Houthis were then able to access documents or information that were previously held either by the Americans in the NSB or the Yemeni government. And that then fell into the hands of the Houthis, and they had access to that information.
Speaking to us from London on the very chaotic situation in Yemen, Iona Craig is a reporter who has covered Yemen for many years. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So you won't find the word Votorama in the U.S. Constitution as we move to Capitol Hill now, but it is a well-known ritual on Capitol Hill in which senators can offer an unlimited number of amendments to the budget legislation. And voting can stretch out for hours. The last Votorama took place in 2013 and included votes on 100 amendments in 13 hours. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
Any chance they're going to break the 100 amendment, 13-hour sort of, I guess that's not a record, but are they going to go more than that?
One of the best parlor games on Capitol Hill is the over-under. How many votes will there be today and tonight? And nobody actually knows, because they don't know until the process gets started. John, if you are a person who craves combining the drama of C-SPAN with the endurance of a super marathon, then your time has come. It's Votorama, and it's real. What's going to happen is, look, the budget resolution process goes on for 50 hours. This is in the rules. As you said, amendments are unlimited, but then you have to do them all at once, and it's an endurance test. You keep voting until people can't vote anymore. Hundreds and hundreds will be offered. Somewhere between 50 and 100 will be voted on. And here's the thing. They can be anything. Amendments that have already been offered, John, they're going to range from real substance to putting your opponents in a political box to some that are just wacky. There's going to be lots and lots of millionaire taxes. Democrats are going to have a strategy here to raise taxes on the very, very rich to pay for infrastructure and education. They want to raise the minimum wage. There's going to be votes on dental care, votes on Alzheimer's research, votes on boosting up the NIH. There'll be votes on Iran nuclear sanctions, votes on corporate jets for millionaires, lots of votes on immigration. But then you'll probably also see some votes on long-eared bats, preserving the greater prairie chicken in Texas, or maybe relaxing some regulations that designates that an endangered species and gives farmers a hard time. All kinds of stuff going on the floor today. But a lot of this stuff, it sounds wacky, does have political implications later on.
And, you know, I'm glad they're getting around to the prairie chicken. But really, you know, these are things that are fun to make fun of. But what's the chance that these contribute to the legislative process and actually end up framing what the budget blueprint is going to look like?
Well, to the legislative process, they probably don't do much. There's a chance that they do if Republicans get through the long, almost year-long process of budgeting, budget reconciliation, and then appropriations. But these, a lot of, John, the campaign commercials that you see, Senator Jones refused to crack down on Iran. Well, there's probably a factual basis to that commercial, and you know what it is? An obscure vote maybe in Votorama where somebody said, I want to amend the budget for new Iran sanctions. And if you don't want to do that, because President Obama and the administration's in the middle of the P5 plus one, it comes back to bite you in 2016 with a commercial that says you refuse to crack down on Iran. You see how it works?
Yes, and that in a sense contributes to the campaign, but not to the legislative process.
And it can contribute to the legislative process depending on the substance. There's plenty of substance that's already gone on, and there's going to be some more. It depends on the issue. Yeah, Greater Prairie Chicken, maybe not. There might be some there. But look, Republicans are locked in a war among themselves. We've mentioned this. The defense hawks versus the fiscal hawks. People like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Kelly Ayotte are insisting on more money for defense that busts the sequestration caps. They need to go above it or they won't vote for the budget. They've said so. The fiscal hawks say we're not spending on the deficit and we're not spending any more. We like sequestration. There's a battle going on, and amendments in Votorama, you have to watch them because they can dicker for votes and try to get more money for defense to bust the sequestration caps and then negotiate with the House. So there's plenty of politics and plenty of substance embedded in there too.
What are people saying to you about all this?
That it's going to go long. It's going to go long. I have an over-under of about 72 votes today, John.
All right. Well, we'll hold you to that, Todd. Thanks so much.
You got it.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Michael Lewis has done it again. The author who loves to pull back the curtain to expose the hidden workings and absurdities of businesses from baseball to Wall Street lit up the trading floors a year ago when his book Flash Boys was released in hardcover. High-frequency traders with their rapid-fire algorithms have rigged the market with technology and complexity, he wrote. So no, you happy pensioners down in Florida watching CNBC. Anyone cannot play this game, whatever you might believe. Well, we wanted to check in with Lewis to see what his indictment of the markets had wrought outside of some very entertaining financial television. He said, not much. High-tech trading may have originally been a means for leveling the playing field, but it hasn't worked out that way.
The early days of eliminating the middlemen on the New York Stock Exchange, I think it was outsiders who were, you know, freaks and geeks who saw that there was a better way to do it. And you could disrupt this whole industry with technology and actually save investors a lot of money. That all happens before my story starts. My story starts really in 2008 when the people who are the masters of the electronic stuff, the computer guys who design the systems, have taken over the market. I mean, the market's all electronic. And they start to recreate a similar sort of grift that the old system had. They at least figure out ways to exploit glitches in the system so that they can reintroduce lots of unnecessary trading, intermediation, of the same sort that existed before. The characters in the story of my book are kind of counter-revolutionaries. They are all technical people. They're all people who are comfortable writing code and understanding code. But they've become upset that the market didn't become what it was supposed to become. It was supposed to become a place where you eliminated this kind of scalp that goes on in the market. And instead, the scalp just became electronic.
So instead of, you know, J.P. Morgan making a side deal at a drunken dinner in nanoseconds, the software will do the same thing.
You know, in essence, I mean, with the software, so instead of when you give your big stock market order to some bank to execute, instead of the bank's traders seeing the order physically, it's built into the code now. In extraordinary ways, in ways you could never see if you weren't an inside the market. And so the main character of this book is inside the market. Brad Katsuyama is the head stock market trader at the Royal Bank of Canada. One day in 2006 or 2007, when he looks at his trading screens, the markets on his trading screens are accurate. You know, if the screens say he can buy 10,000 shares of Microsoft at 20, if he hits a button, he buys them 10,000 shares of Microsoft at 20. The next day, after the scalp has been built into it, when he hits a button to buy those shares, they vanish. They vanish because they know he wants to buy the shares. The high-frequency traders who sit in the middle of the market have detected his signal and are front-running it. Mm. And it is happening so fast that unless you actually have granular data about, I mean, like microsecond-level data about what's happening in the market, you don't see the grift.
You remember the movie The Sting?
Yep.
There's the great scam that they do at the end where they are playing the horse races, and they know the outcome of the horse race a few minutes before the actual information is disseminated to everyone else, and they get somebody to bet on the wrong horse, knowing the outcome, and rip him off.
Right.
Is this the software yes. version of the Sting?
It's exactly the software
oh
version
of
Sting.
Oh, my God, that's so
this
wild.
This is what it is. That you have essentially you think of it as a class system in the stock market. You have a handful, and it really is a handful, of high-frequency trading firms and high-frequency arms of the trading arms of the big banks that buy fast access to faster information from the exchanges, that make a lot of money selling them this faster access. So they get a picture of the market and no market price movements before investors do. Now, the difference is a matter of milliseconds. They know, but it's enough because they have a right to trade against you essentially at a stale price, and they know it's the stale price. So if you're in the market to buy Microsoft at $20 a share or wherever it is, and they know it just fell to $19.99, they will sell it to you at buy it at $19.99 and sell it to you at $20. It's a very valuable thing, having a few millisecond advantage. In fact, in one way, think about the book is just a story about the value of a millisecond.
The value of a millisecond.
Yeah.
When this book came out in hardcover, there were some spectacular theatrics that went with you going on some of the financial channels,
which had nothing to do with me. You know, I was dragged into these theatrics that were orchestrated by others. But yes, there were.
And there was this huge debate, which probably was an important debate to have, about whether the stock market was completely rigged. And there you were in the middle, and it seemed as though CNBC wanted to get you.
Yep.
You know, Michael and Brad, shame on both of you for falsely accusing literally thousands of people and possibly scaring millions of investors in an effort to promote a business model. Now, Sue, it's a very, very old tactic to try to build a business on the planks of fear, mistrust, and accusation. This has certainly taken that to a new level.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I thought I was going on an interview just to be interviewed by the host of CNBC, but in rolled the president of the BATS Stock Exchange, the exchange that's on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, created by high-frequency traders, basically for the benefit of high-frequency traders. And he was there to tell me how shameful it was. I'd written a book that undermined confidence in the American financial system and so on and so forth. A line of attack, which, by the way, I found breathtaking because I just thought, did anybody actually think anybody in America trusts Wall Street anymore? I mean, my God, is anybody paying attention to what we just came through? But anyway, that was the first line of attack. And thank God the main character of my book, Brad Katsuyama, was on the show with me because it's a very complicated subject. It's very easy to go on the television and just lie, and nobody will call you on it because they're not quite sure. And I had with me maybe the world's authority on how the stock market actually works and how the exchanges actually work. And in the course of this shout fest, he started
fabulous.
It was a real. He was just shouting the whole time. Brad asked him some pointed questions about how his exchange worked, and he actually gave the wrong answers. He misinformed the public about how his exchange worked.
96% of the volume executed on our system is by customers using those data products. And that runs the gamut from bulge bracket firms, retail brokerage firms and their advocates and intermediaries. You don't understand that a market has always had intermediaries. Since the beginning of financial markets at scale, there's going to be someone who at the time needs to be in the middle.
Can I tell you whether this is incorrect?
This is 96% you're referring to is the proprietary feeds that you're saying that everybody's been arguing about.
Then Michael.
There's a difference between a subscriber using a proprietary feed versus what a pegged order, a priced order, price sliding, anytime the exchange is responsible for pricing data.
You use the same data that we do.
Absolutely not. You guys use the SIP to price trades in
direct. That is not true.
Funny enough, I think he'd have been fine even doing that because the anchors on CNBC didn't call him on it.
They just
let it go. The point Brad was getting at when asking the questions is it true that you provide a kind of slow – in ordinary investors with a slow picture of the market and high-frequency traders with a faster picture of the market? And he said no. But the next day, the New York Attorney General got involved.
Yeah.
You can't lie about your business on national television, you know? And they had – and Bats had to print a correction. And this man lost his job a few months later. But if the New York Attorney General had not gotten involved, I think no one would have been the wiser. I think the audience would have been left thinking, I'm not sure who's telling the truth there. Which is the problem. It's not the problem just with the complexity of the stock market. This is a problem that arises out of the complexity of the financial system. At some point, it gets so complicated that what you saw happen in that CNBC shout fest happens, you know, inside of in conversations inside the SEC or on Capitol Hill, and the audience, the SEC commissioners or the senators who are trying to decide whether we do something about this, are baffled. They don't know which side is telling the truth, and it's too complicated to untangle. So we pay a huge price for this complexity. It means the public can't really – it has a hard time understanding how the system works and therefore has a hard time having a view on what should be done about it.
Two things before we go. One, as I watched those theatrics, it became clear to me in the general picture of this complexity that you describe and really came clearly through the conversation that, you know, we've grown to understand that the set on the New York Stock Exchange is a TV set, that nothing really happens there, and the NASDAQ set is just a photo op for people, and that's all kind of a charade. But it became clear to me that even the people talking about the market on these financial channels and the ups and downs of the various indices is also kind of a charade, that it's not really happening there at all.
It's not happening there at all. It's funny. It's like we cling to this old picture of what the stock market is without actually getting our minds around what it really is. And what it really is black boxes scattered across New Jersey. And the people who were putting themselves on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ physically to pretend like they're inside the market, they might as well be in Denver. I mean, they're nowhere near what's happening. What's happening is happening on the level of the algorithm. So
the conspiratorial analysis could be those people are hired to be on TV so that the pensioners in Florida will have something to watch so that they don't sell and drive the market down.
That's not a great leap to make.
It's
not so far-fetched, except that, you know, like a lot of things that look like conspiracies in America, even in America financial life, or things that just kind of happen by accident and makes everybody comfortable, and nobody really thinks of it as a conspiracy. But it is true that a false picture of the markets is conveyed every day by financial news networks, not really consciously, intentionally. But it's just – you can't really – there's no picture of the other thing. How do you put an algorithm on TV? Mm-hmm. You know, what you really need to know about the market if you're an investor is when I hit the button on my computer to say buy or sell, where does it go? What's the code that determines how it's executed? Is it – for example, I was talking the other day with someone who used to write code for a high-frequency trading firm. And he said, we had code that if you want to buy 1,000 shares of Microsoft, the code was really smart in using the first 500 shares of your purchase to buy really stupidly to drive the price of Microsoft up. So you're chasing the market up. And then with the second 500 shares, we would short to you at a high price Microsoft, knowing it was going to come back down. So how do you get to that truth? The only way you get to that truth is if you examine the code. I don't know who's examining the code.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. But yeah. it's uh, unless you're actually got people who can read computer code and connect it to the reality of the marketplace, you have no ability to evaluate it. And so with all this nonsense on the television set is a distraction.
What's in your mattress?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what's in my mattress. How I, you know what keeps me sane?
Yeah.
I do have a possibly naive sense that having gone through this trauma so recently, that the individuals, even if they're badly incentivized, are being either watched a little differently or behaving a little differently just because nobody actually wants to have a financial crisis.
No, no.
Right? It's not like it's anybody's great interest to have one. It may be in their interest to do the things that lead to one, but they don't actually looking to create one. I own shares in Berkshire Hathaway. And I think if it all goes really bad, Warren Buffett ends up making a killing. So he's my hedge. Warren Buffett sits there always with a huge pile of cash waiting to buy people at distressed prices. So that's the only way I kind of I stay sane.
Well done. Michael Lewis, bestselling author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short, and other books. His most recent book is Flash Boys. And here's something to take with you today. The legendary Portland advertising firm Wieden & Kennedy has given us a gruesome backstory to a legendary tagline. It turns out that the Nike slogan, Just Do It, might have been a lyric from the executioner's song, Norman Mailer's book, about a murder case in Utah back in 1977. Executioner's song told the story of Gary Gilmore's violent crime spree from Portland, Oregon, to his death by firing squad in Utah. Dan Wieden, co-founder of the firm, was struggling to find a tagline for a line of sportswear, and he recalled Gilmore's last words, "Let's do it." Wieden didn't think that was quite right, so he tweaked it to, "Just do it." Makes you think the next time you try and stare down a pitcher. Just do it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Do we have enough time for that other line, that other thing, listen back to anything on the show? Okay, right. You can listen back to anything you heard on today's show by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe. To our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast fixed. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.